Daniel 10 through 12, we're going to do the rest of the book because I'm tired of Daniel. I'm not tired of it, but after a while, it's the same stuff over and over again. Daniel is a repetitive book. He just keeps receiving visions of the same thing. And if you've been here through all these lessons, you've seen that as basically Daniel's been shown like four or five different visions of the period between the Persians and the Romans. He received two visions of the four. He had the four pieces of the statue and then the four beasts that came up out of the ground that were the same four kingdoms. And then he received a vision for the ram and the goat. It was talking about Greece taking over Persia. He received a vision about Babylon falling. So just the same, it's the same historical period over and over and over again. So tonight we're going to do 10 through 12, which is one conversation split up. And I've said this before. I don't know who did the chapter and verse breaks at one point, but there's perhaps no place I like them less than Daniel 10 through 12. The chapter breaks are terrible where they're placed in the text. They're just not well done. So we're going to do 10 through 12 tonight. So the outline of this, Daniel sees a terrifying figure in 10, 1 through 14, and then a different guy, a different figure, a more normal looking guy, it says one with the appearance of a man, consoles Daniel in 10, 15 through 11, 1. That's the first bad chapter break. The messenger tells Daniel the future that's going to take place, which is, again, it's the same time period we've already looked at in 11, 2 through 12, 4. That's the second bad chapter break. And then Daniel is told to seal up the message in 12, 5 through 13, the conclusion of the book. And the foretelling, the prophecy, the thing that the man tells Daniel, the vision of this the king of the north and the king of the south, it kind of sounds like a Game of Thrones thing. The foretelling is fairly straightforward if you've heard the lessons up to this point, because it's just repeating the same stuff. Now, it is odd in that this is probably one of the most specific prophecies in the entirety of the Bible. Like, there's some oddly specific stuff in chapter 11 in this prophecy of the kings, and we'll get to that, but for the most part, it's just rehashing the same stuff. Daniel 11, 2 through 4, we're going to skip around in the text. I have an outline that I hope makes sense. We're going to talk about the vision, and then we're going to talk about the messengers, the angelic beings, because I think there's some interesting stuff in that. Now, I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he will stir up all against the kingdom of Greece, and then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided to the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, that is, not to his kids, right? His kids aren't going to get the kingdom, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, that is, it's going to be lesser than, like, the total of the four kingdoms is going to be less than the total of the kingdom this guy ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. So it's not just the four, right? But there's going to be even more of his kingdom. That the most of it is going to go to these four kings. But even some of it's going to go to people other than these four kings. And we've looked at that already, right? This chart, this map right here, explains all of that quite nicely, what happened after Alexander died, because this is Alexander, probably. So you've got the Seleucids and the Ptolemies and the weird names, Lysimachus and Cassander and Antigonus, and that's five kingdoms, but you see the red outline. That is the extent of Alexander's empire. So these five kings, they didn't even get to rule all of what Alexander ruled. He was quite a historical figure. And it's not hard to see how this eventual breakdown of the kingdom of Greece fits this prophecy in Daniel 11, 2 through 4. Now, eventually, as we go through, the narrative condenses down to two kings. Let's read this. This is 5 and 6. Then the king of the south shall be strong, but one of his princes shall be stronger than he and shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. And after some years, they shall make an alliance. The daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. This is an alliance by marriage. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, and she shall be given up, and her attendants, he who fathered her and he who supported her in those times. So this vision, he starts out with the four kings, but then the rest of it in chapter 11, not the rest of it, but the middle section in chapter 11 is these two kings, which coincidentally, the lands outside of Macedonia, that is Greece proper, that kingdom eventually did condense down to two kings. It was the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. They eventually conquered all of it, except for that little part up in Greece proper, which is over here. They held on to that. But over time, the Seleucids took, and their kingdom goes all the way over there, and the Ptolemies goes all the way down here. It just condensed down to those two kings. And you'll notice, if you will, what is in the middle of those two kingdoms. Isn't that Israel and Jerusalem? Right there, smack dab. We got one kingdom in the south of Israel, boom, right there, and one kingdom in the north of Israel. They cover all that territory right there. And it's pretty, again, it's not hard to figure out historically. The Seleucids, the Ptolemies sent one of their daughters to the Seleucids to marry, sort of an alliance of marriage between these two kingdoms. And then the guy, the Seleucid king, he's like, nah, I don't want this marriage anymore. He divorced that lady and went back to his previous wife, and the whole thing fell apart. And it's just, you go through chapter 11, we're not going to read all of it, and it just describes essentially the conflicts between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. That's all it does. Now, it's interesting, Daniel 11:14 sort of slid in there. In those times, many shall arise against the king of the south, the Ptolemies, and the violent among your own people, which is who? Isn't that the Jews? That's Daniel's own people as the Jews, shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. The Maccabean period, which is the intertestamental period, so many Jewish revolts that just failed one after the other. They wanted to be free of outside rule. We understand that. And this continued into the Roman period. Over and over, the Jews tried to revolt and take back their kingdom. Again, note they're squished. You can see, I don't know if you can tell the color difference. You can see it right in there, squished in the middle of these two kingdoms. And they wanted to be free, but they kept fighting over them. And they just couldn't. They kept failing over and over and over. So the narrative eventually, Daniel 11, switches to the primary focus of the vision from 21 onward, switches to one king of the Seleucids, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. I don't know if this is important to you to know, but it's interesting. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, even the prince of the covenant. And this guy, Antiochus, notice he doesn't have the name Seleucid or Ptolemy, because he wasn't from either of those lines. He just sort of came in and slipped into power and took over one day, and sort of not by a military force, right? He just sort of came in and took over. And the rest of the text in Daniel 11, well, not the rest of it, but most of it, continues until verse 45, describing what he would do to the Jews, which he did a lot of bad stuff. He ruled from 175 to 164. He was not a great king. He was quite a despicable person. Daniel 11:31, forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and the fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. This phrase has appeared several times in Daniel, a lot of variants to it, the abominations, the desolator, etc., etc. And here, as they do elsewhere in Daniel, when this phrase appears in Daniel, it means that something is being corrupted in the temple. That's what it means, always. It's not referring to something in the future. It's not referring to something the Antichrist is going to do. In Daniel, when he talks about the abominations or the desolations, he's describing a corruption of the temple worship in Jerusalem, which incidentally, Antiochus IV, that's what he did in 168 BC. He went right into Jerusalem and set up a temple to, or not a temple, he set up an altar to Zeus right smack dab in the temple in Jerusalem. That was the abomination that makes desolate. He took away the regular burnt offering, that is the burnt offering that should be in the temple to Jehovah, Yahweh, and set up this altar to Zeus. That was it. And coincidentally, when Jesus makes reference to this then in Matthew 24, then when you see the abominations of the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, Jesus is referring to the same thing. A corruption of the temple in Jerusalem when Nero comes in and wipes everything out and destroys the temple in 70. All is the same stuff. Now, a lot of Daniel chapter 11 is about Antiochus exalting himself above God, making himself out to be God. And again, it's just the same stuff that's been in Daniel over and over again. All the kings in Daniel do that. They eventually exalt themselves against God and find only death and destruction. It did not end well for Antiochus. Just like it didn't end well for Nebuchadnezzar or Belshazzar or any of the kings that we've looked at. They all try to be God and they all fail miserably. So that's the basically in a nutshell what happens in chapter 11. If you want to talk about that more, I'm happy to. We're skipping over the rest of it for now. I didn't read all the text, but if you want more, there's more detail, if you want the detail, about who in Seleucid and who in Ptolemy was the different things, but we're not going to go over all that. Chapter 12 gives us another indicator of the limit of these visions. That is to say, when in history do these visions take place? That's the question that we want to answer when we talk about Daniel. And chapter 12 gives us the end, the limit of the visions, when the visions will be completed. Daniel 12, 1 and 2. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never been since there was a nation till that time. That's a little bit of hyperbole. That's what happens in these apocalyptic visions. But at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone whose name shall be found written in the book. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. To my knowledge, there is only one instance of a limited resurrection like this. And I say limited because not everybody's going to raise, right? Just many people will raise. It's not talking about the end of time. At the end of time, everybody's going to raise. To my knowledge, in the entirety of history, there's only one instance of a limited resurrection like this. When was that? Wasn't that at the cross? That the whole event surrounding the cross and many came out of the tombs, right? Daniel 12, 6 through 7. And someone said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, Daniel sees two guys across the way, how long shall it be till the end of these wonders? That is, when will these things end, these visions? And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the streams, he raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever, that it would be for a time, times and half a time, three and a half times, whatever that means, and that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end, all these things would be finished. All what things? Well, all the things he just got done talking about in chapter 11. This is why I hate the chapter breaks, because chapter 12 is directly talking about the things that he talked to him about in chapter 11. It's all one conversation. So the end of the things that would be finished is the vision he talked about in chapter 11. When would that happen? The shattering of the power of the holy people. Who are the holy people? Well, there's only two possibilities, historically. It's either talking about the Jews or it's talking about the Christians. That's it. That's all. Biblically speaking, those are the only two contextually correct answers to that question. Well, do we think the shattering of the church is ever going to happen? We're promised, right, that that's never going to happen. That the power of the church will never be shattered. The power of the Christians wrapped up in the kingdom of heaven, that's never going away. We're promised that over and over again. So it must be referring then to the other group of holy people, which would be the Israelites. And when was their power shattered? Wasn't it again what Jesus talks about in Matthew 24, the destruction of the temple in AD 70? All of these things go together. It's almost like God planned it that way. That when Daniel is talking about all of these visions in the latter half of Daniel, that he's talking about the time period between the Persian Empire and the eventual removal of the temple in Jerusalem in 70. That is the time period that is being discussed. Which, of course, if we go back to chapter 7, we go back to chapter 2, he describes those four kingdoms and those four beasts, the things that he talks about over and over again. And then what is the fifth kingdom, the fifth thing? Is always the coming of the Son of Man, right? The arrival of the kingdom that will never be shaken, which would be the church, which again happened in that first century time period. These things all fit together quite nicely. All of these things, everything we've looked at in Daniel chapter 11, everything really we've looked at in Daniel, took place before the end of the first century AD. All of these visions, none of it has to do with the future from now, I should say. That, of course, all had to do with the future from Daniel, but none of it had to do with the future from us. Of more specific interest to us in these last chapters is the dealings of the angelic beings. And as I was studying for this lesson, I was trying to think of a way, think of something that I could say that is not just the same thing I've said for the past 10 weeks, which is it's going to describe the Greeks and the Persians and the Romans and God's in control of the kingdoms and, you know, all the same lessons that we've had from all these different prophecies, right? Kings will elevate themselves against God and eventually will be overthrown. It's just the same lessons over and over. But in 10 and 11 and 12, of particular interest, of different interest, is the dealings of these angelic beings. We've got some interesting figures in 10 and 11 and 12. Beginning with the terrifying figure of chapter 10, Daniel 10, 5 and 6, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt like fine gold from Uphaz around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. Now, if you're familiar with Revelation at all, or Ezekiel has the same vision, you will immediately note the similarities to how the Son of Man, Jesus, is described in Revelation. Ezekiel has a similar vision. And indeed, many have said that this is describing the second person of the Godhead, but I'm not so sure that that's the case because of what follows in the next few verses, 12 through 14. He said to me, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I was left there with the kings of Persia and came to make you understand what is to happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for days yet to come." Would the second aspect of deity himself need assistance? Like this prince of Persia could withstand Jesus himself, whatever Jesus wants to do? Now, perhaps the prince of Persia might withstand some angelic being, which is why I think it's more likely that this is not describing, that this is not describing Jesus, the second person of the Godhead, because why would he need assistance from Michael? That just seems ridiculous to me. Deity himself needing some assistance from a lowly angel. So it's more likely to me that we're describing two different angelic beings, Michael and this terrifying figure, whoever it is, we're not told the name. Some think perhaps it's Gabriel because he's had interactions with Gabriel before, though I'm not sure it's Gabriel either because he didn't have this sort of terrifying presence when he dealt with Daniel before, but it might have been Gabriel. We don't really know. Who is the prince of Persia? The second thing in this that's interesting is the phrasing, the differences in the phrasing between when the word prince is used and the word king is used. And you'll notice that Michael, who we know from other places in Scripture, is an archangel. Michael is called a chief of the princes, that is, an archangel, right? Prince there being used as a word to denote a heavenly being. And it's interesting because he talks about the prince of Persia, the prince of the kingdom of Persia, but then later it talks about the kings of Persia. And I think contextually speaking, as we go through chapter 10 and 11 and 12, the word prince here is being used primarily to describe angelic heavenly beings. I don't know what that means exactly, some sort of non-physical entity. And when the word king is used, it's describing the physical earthly king. Because are we really to think that some mortal man could withstand this terrifying figure of heavenly might? That some prince of Persia, some mortal human dude, could sort of do anything that would impede the progress of this heavenly being? So I think it's much more likely that the prince of Persia that withstands this being for 21 days is another angel. Now, not an angel of God, right? An angel of the adversary. We're getting a glimpse of a much greater reality in 10, 11, and 12. And it's somewhat unique in Scripture, really. The peek behind the curtain, I use that term a lot. I have it in my slides here. The peek behind the curtain, as it were. That there's another plane of existence that we don't really get to know about that much. That things are going on and things are happening and there's battles being fought and there's missions being accomplished that you and I will never, ever know about. Except we get a little bit of a glimpse of it right here in 10, 11, and 12. It seems to be that this figure, whoever he was, wanted to come to Daniel for 21 days, and yet he was opposed by this other being. He wanted to come sooner, but he couldn't. He said, "Daniel, God has heard your words. God has heard the things that you have pleaded, that he's heard your humility, and he knows you want to understand, and so he sent me to come talk to you about this, but I was waylaid by this other angelic being, an angel of not God, to be sure." We keep going in 10, 20 through 11, 1. This is the other figure. So the terrifying figure, the figure that is so awesome that Daniel can't even talk to him. And it's interesting, you should read all of chapter 10 at some point. This figure, his presence is so terrifying that Daniel's basically struck mute and falls over, basically faints because of how awesome this being appears to be. So another guy comes along, one whose appearance was like the Son of Man. Just a normal-looking guy, which we know, of course, angels can appear like normal-looking fellows. We see that in the story of Abraham, right? That they come to Abraham around the campfire, and he doesn't even know they're angels until a certain time later. He said, "Do you know why I've come to you? But now I will return to the fight against the prince of Persia, and I will go. When I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these, against two, the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him." Now, this is why I think the chapter break, you look in your Bibles, the chapter break for chapter 12 is right there. And man, is it terrible. It's just awful. Because putting the chapter break there makes it seem like this sentence is not part of this paragraph. But this is all one conversation, guys. 10, 11, and 12 is one event. So the chapter break in chapter 12, if you're the kind of person to write in your Bibles, just take your pen and cross out that big fat 12, because it's horrible. It's a horrible 12. Because this is him continuing, or no, it's actually the 11, right? I think I did that wrong. Yeah, it's the 11, not the 12. You can cross out the 12 too, because it's also terrible, but I meant the 11 in this particular instance. Just cross them all out, guys. Cross them all out. Because what is he saying here? This is all one stream of dialogue. That this Son of Man, whoever it was, he came to Daniel for a time to talk to him, but then I got to go back to the fight. I got to go back and deal with this prince of Persia. And when I deal with him, eventually I know the prince of Greece is going to come. Not this mortal king, but some other figure that he's dealing with these guys. And it's kind of like he's a pair with Michael, right? That Michael and him are sort of fighting this battle together. And so he says then at the beginning of chapter 11, this is a continuation of the same dialogue. As for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Him who? Well, not Darius. Stood up to confirm and strengthen Michael in this fight against these princes, whoever they are. So we've got this sort of combination going on of this one like a son of man. Again, we don't know who it is. I think it's much more likely that this is Gabriel, although Daniel would have recognized him, I guess. I don't know. These two angelic beings fighting against these other two angelic beings. I think, as I said, this is a peek behind the curtain, that things are going on even today. Angelic or entities are doing things that we have no idea about. The princes of Greece and Persia are the counterpart of Michael and the speaker, one for the adversary, of course, the devil. Now, a particular note also is this little word "your" in here. Michael, your prince. Why the "your" there? Well, we've seen the prince of Persia. We've seen the prince of Greece. Now we see Michael, your prince. That is the prince of Israel, right? That's who that would be. And we see that again, Daniel 12:1. At that time shall arise Michael, the great prince who has charge of your people. Implying what? That Michael had a particular relationship with Israel. We see this in Jude 2, right? Or not Jude 2, but Jude also. Jude also refers to Michael. Michael disputing with the devil about the body of Moses. Because it seems to be that Michael had a particularly special or unique relationship with Israel that the other angels just didn't have. That Michael had been put in charge of Israel and accomplishing whatever needed to happen in Israel according to God's plan. But God's plan does not just concern Israel, right? God has a plan for Greece, and God has a plan for Rome, and God has a plan for China, and God has a plan for whoever. And it does seem to be, if we can extrapolate from this, maybe we can't, but it does seem to be the case that these angelic beings are assigned to their countries, as it were. That here, you're in charge of making sure that what I want to happen happens in this country. And it seems that Michael was the person that was put in charge of making sure God's plan was carried out in the nation of Israel specifically. But obviously there were angels that had charge over other nations. And so when we talk about this contending that was happening, God had a plan for Greece and Persia, the plan that he was going to take place in all those visions, right? All these visions we see of Greece and Persia and the kings, the south, and the kings in the north, and all these things, the goat and the ram, all the things we've talked about in the book of Daniel, those were things that God had planned that needed to happen. And yet, of course, the devil was going to oppose that. And so when Michael is contending against the prince of Persia, he's not contending against the king, he's contending against the devil who wants to foil the plans of God. This battle that is taking place, that you or I never see, but that I am fully convinced is happening today. I'm never going to know about it. I'm never going to have an awareness of it. But I am sure that there are angels battling over God's plan for the world today. The heavy implication in Daniel 10 through 12 is that there are heavenly beings at work in all nations implementing the plan of God. Michael just happened to be the one given charge over Israel. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 through 6. For though we walk in the flesh, we are not waging war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. There are spiritual strongholds. I don't know what those are exactly. Part of it has to do with this idea, right? We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God and take every thought captive to obey Christ, ready to punish every disobedience when your obedience is complete. The battle that we fight is not flesh and blood, but it is part of a much larger battle that is taking place on a level of existence that we don't get to experience. But that doesn't mean it's not there. So what's the conclusion then? What's the point of Daniel for us? As we conclude the book of Daniel, I think it's fitting the way that the book concludes, Daniel 12, 9 through 13, because this is, Daniel's been given all this knowledge. He's been given all this information, all this amazing information that he doesn't really know what to do with it. He's been given it. He writes it down, right? But what is he supposed to do with that knowledge? What is he supposed to do with this understanding of the future? And let's be honest, Daniel probably didn't have any idea. Maybe he had some. But I very much doubt Daniel knew that the Seleucids would come and then Antiochus IV Epiphanes would come. The specifics of that were probably clouded to Daniel just because he was a normal person. He's been given a glimpse, a vision of it, but he's not given anything near specifics. And so the conclusion for Daniel is the conclusion for us. We know that all these things are taking place, that there's a higher level of existence, that there's a battle raging around us that we are a part of, yes, but we're not given the whole picture. We're not given the whole battle plan. What are we to do with the limited information that we have? What are we to do with this knowledge of this greater plane of existence that we can't really affect? What are we to do with that? Go your way, Daniel. For the words are shut up and sealed until the time of the end. Many shall purify themselves and make themselves white and be refined, but the wicked shall act wickedly. And none of the wicked shall understand, but those who are wise shall understand. And from the time that the regular burnt offering is taken away and the abomination that makes desolate is set up, there shall be 1,290 days. Blessed is he who waits and arrives at the 1,335 days. But go your way till the end, and you shall rest and shall stand in your allotted place at the end of days. Daniel, I've given you all sorts of knowledge that you cannot act on. There's nothing that Daniel could have done to influence this one way or the other. He's given this information, I think, to relay to the people of Israel for the intertestamental period, the time when God is not going to communicate with the people of Israel. That ends after the book of Malachi. There's a 400-year period of time, a 400-year gap where Israel's not going to receive any divine communication from God. Well, Daniel gives them the roadmap, okay? I know God's not talking to us, but we can look at the book of Daniel and see that God still has a plan for what's happening in these 400 years, and yet Daniel can't act on it to change anything. Daniel, go your way. Go do your own thing. I've given you this vision that you cannot affect and you cannot change. Go and do what you do. Be faithful. Be righteous. Blessed is he who remains, who waits and arrives. The conclusion for us is the same as it would have been for Daniel, I think. At the end, he is only responsible for his own righteousness. He can't control the king of the south and the king of the north. He can't control the ram and the goat. All Daniel can control is whether he will remain faithful or not. Will he remain humble? As he said, from the day you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before God, I have heard you. Will Daniel remain in his humbleness and seeking to understand God's will? At the end, Daniel is only in charge of his own relationship with God as we are. The wicked will not understand God's will, either through ignorance or choice. Some wickedness is done by ignorance, to be sure, and yet a lot of it is done by choice, a willing refusal to understand. Not that they can't understand, but that they choose not to understand. We should not be surprised that the unrighteous people do not understand the Bible. That should not be surprising to us, that the wicked would not understand what's in here. Because either they're wicked because they don't understand, or they don't understand because they're wicked. One of the two. There's a difference between those. Think about it for a while. Endurance is all that is required. Daniel's not expected to change anything. He's not actually even told to tell people, right? It's interesting the way that it's said. He's told to seal up the words. He does tell people, and I think that's fine, but it's interesting that Daniel's not even instructed to go tell Israel. He's informed of these things, and he passes that on to others, but all that is required of Daniel is to endure until the end. And he says that, right? He says, from the time that the burnt offering is taken away and the abomination is set up shall be 1290 days. Blessed is he who waits and arrives. Now, Daniel, of course, wouldn't have been there for that, right? Daniel would have been long dead. But all those people that lived during the time of Antiochus IV, they weren't expected to overthrow Antiochus. They had no recourse of doing that. And in fact, the one time when the vision talks about Israel rising up, what does it say? That people will rise up and they will fail. You're not expected to change the world. You're expected to remain faithful to God. Change the lives of the individuals in your life. Remain faithful in times of difficulty. In the end, we all go to our allotted place. And that's what Daniel is told at the end, right? You shall rest and stand in your allotted place at the end of the days. Daniel, there is rest for you if you remain faithful, if you keep your relationship with God. Don't worry about all this other stuff. Don't worry about all these kings of the north and kings of the south and the goat and the ram and the vision of the four beasts rising up out of the ocean. Don't worry about that. Don't concern yourself with that. At the end, you shall find rest in your allotted place if you have remained faithful. And the conclusion is the same for us. You and I will go to our allotted place, the place that we have demonstrated we belong by the lives that we lived and our willingness to remain faithful to God. Amen? So let's remain steadfast and arrive at the end ready to receive that rest.